Welcome to Survival Mode Disrupted, the podcast for those who are done performing, done people pleasing, and done living life on autopilot. I'm your host, Leticia, the Survival Mode Disruptor, and this is where we create disruptive, unapologetic transformations for those who are ready to exit survival mode and reclaim their power. Every episode is your permission slip to burn the rule book, break the cycle, and finally build a life that feels like yours. So let's disrupt everything that's holding you back and start living life on your own terms. This is your trigger warning. This podcast is raw. It is real, and it doesn't sugarcoat what it means to survive trauma, abuse, mental health battles, or even the aftermath of living in survival mode for too damn long. What you hear on Survival Mode Disrupted includes unfiltered stories, graphic details, and a vulnerable truth that may trigger some of the audience. Please prioritize your emotional safety. If something feels too heavy, pause. Breathe. Come back when you're ready or not at all. Your healing is yours to honor. These episodes are based on lived experience, not therapy sessions or clinical advice. Listening does not replace mental health treatment or constitute a coach-client relationship. If you're in crisis, please seek immediate help from a licensed professional or contact your local emergency services. This space is built with care, but it's also built for truth and built for disruption. Take what you need, leave the rest, and most of all, trust yourself. If this podcast speaks to your soul, you don't have to do this work alone. Feel free to join our free Facebook community for high-achieving women ready to break cycles and heal out loud. Join us at Disrupting Survival Mode on Facebook, or grab the book that started this movement, Exiting Survival Mode, a raw step-by-step guide to help you identify, release, and rebuild from the survival patterns that have been keeping you stuck. Hello, 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 and welcome back to another episode of Survival Mode Disrupted. I am your host, Leticia, the Survival Mode Disruptor, and today we have Heidi with us. Heidi, why don't you introduce yourself?
My name is Heidi Johnson. I was a survivor of the calling. I was in the library when that took place, so the deadliest part of the school.
Yeah. Wow, I cannot wait to hear your story. But before we get started, how would you describe survival mode?
Yeah, so survival mode for me is doing whatever it takes, I think, to make it to the next moment, hopefully the next day, just in a place of, you know, doing whatever you have to do. I would say it's close to like a fight or flight type situation where you're just almost existing, not really living, and working to hopefully find yourself in a place where things eventually get better. And so it's just moment by moment, breath by breath, trying to get through every hard emotion, every painful thing that you're going through.
I agree with you wholeheartedly. As someone who was in survival mode for over two decades, it was just autopilot. I was achieving things, but I really wasn't excelling. So tell us your story to and through survival mode.
Yeah, I mean, I experienced a very acute, violent trauma going through the Columbine shooting and back in 1999. At the time, mass shootings here in the United States were unheard of. It wasn't something that was in our consciousness, that we, as students, were scared to go to school. I never went to school and thought that something like that would happen to me. I felt relatively safe for the most part, but I was a sophomore or in 10th grade, April 20th, 1999. Went to the library that day to get some of my homework done. I had cheerleading tryouts the next day. And so I was planning around that, wanted to make sure I could dedicate my evening that night, really focusing on getting my cheerleading tryouts right. And so sat down at a table in the library, looked out at the mountains, and just pulled out my homework, began working. Shortly into the period, I heard these loud bangs start going off. And at first, really didn't think anything of it, was thinking maybe it was construction that they were doing on the school. Wasn't concerned in any way, shape, or form at that point, but was just kind of curious, wondering what that was. They kept going off though, and I kept hearing them just continually. Started to get a little bit concerned, wondering what it was, and a few other students were expressing, you know, maybe a little bit more curiosity, starting to look out windows, question what it was that we were hearing. I know some of these things in hindsight, but a pipe bomb went off right outside of the library, and the doors of the library are open. So the library began to fill with smoke. The lights went off, alarms went on. And from where my table was positioned, I could see the entrance and the exit of the library. And I saw a teacher come running into the room, and she was frantic. Her face was just incredibly pale. And she kept saying over and over again, a kid has been shot. Everybody get under your tables. So I got under my table at that point in time. There was, I think, six chairs around it. And I just crouched under my table and pulled the chairs as close to my body as I possibly could. Kept my head down and just basically waited. I remember looking to my right and, you know, with the smoke still being so present in the light, these two shadowy figures enter. And from what I could see, you know, and I couldn't quite make out their faces, but I could see that they were holding guns. I could see that they were wearing trench coats. And the first thing that they said when they got into the library was, "Everybody get ready to die." From there, they proceeded to just shoot really across the library. And I could hear them just basically killing my fellow students. They came over to my section, and there were computer cubbies directly in front where kids had gotten under, you know, so the computer was on top, and then the student got below to, you know, duck and cover. I saw them point their gun under where the student was and pull the trigger. They came around all over my table and just were, I think, just trying to shoot as many students as they possibly could. I could see their boots through the slats of my table as they passed by. And I kept wondering, you know, what if I'm next? You know, just that feeling of this might very well be my last day on earth. It became very real to me that might happen. And so mentally, I was kind of preparing myself for seeing what your body does when you are in that state of survival where you're preparing yourself to die. I was, in a sense, and in my own way, kind of saying goodbye to my family and friends and pets and even just dreams that I had. I had so many dreams and things that I wanted to accomplish and do that there was a sense of I may not ever have the chance of being able to do those things. I truly, because of what I was witnessing, thought that it was going to be my last moments on earth. They, at one point, came very close to my table, and I made eye contact with one of the shooters and thought, this is it. This is the moment where, you know, they're going to shoot me. And for whatever reason, they didn't. They didn't shoot me. And soon after, they left the library. They went to go check. So the library was on the top floor. Underneath it was the cafeteria. They had put large propane tank bombs in the cafeteria. They went to go check on those bombs because they didn't detonate. they were going to shoot at them to get them to go off. And hopefully, according to them, they wanted to kill all of us that way. They thought that would be more efficient, but they didn't go off. And we took that as I could see that they had left. We took that as a window of time to escape. And so I left out the emergency exit with a bunch of other students. There was a cop car that greeted us there. And that cop car eventually would be able to take us to safety, but we would be really in this kind of secure location for several hours before we were able to go home, before we were able to see our. So we really were in a state of, you know, all of the aftermath that had happened. There were moments of, you know, comforting kids that had been shot, taking off our socks and using them as tourniquets to help stop the bleeding, forming prayer circles with each other and just trying to cope. We were all in so much shock, in such a state of panic and disbelief that we were trying to grapple with what we had just went through in a lot of ways. Post Columbine, I had the opportunity to travel and speak and share my story in churches and in schools. And, you know, really didn't pursue any type of formal like therapy. I think mental health has come so far since that time. It wasn't encouraged for me to pursue that at that moment in time. And so I was really in a place of, I would say, white knuckling it. I was in survival mode for 10 years, trying to just make it. I learned how to manage intense panic attacks and just kind of power through them in a way. But that wasn't sustainable. And inevitably, I had kind of a nervous breakdown when I was 25. So 10 years after the shooting happened, where I just couldn't do it anymore. I physically, mentally could not white knuckle power through those things anymore. I needed to pursue some sort of help. And so that's when I went to therapy, and that's when I started pursuing healing from what I went through.
I think Columbine is that one incident that, like, you say it, you don't even have to say the shooting, you just have to say Columbine. Yeah. And everyone knows what you're talking about. And I remember, yes, being, I was a senior in high school when that happened, and thinking, wow.
Yeah.
So to hear your story, even though this is literally 26 years later, it's still bone chilling. Yes. I actually didn't realize that bombs were involved, you know. So even hearing you talk about the pipe bombs and the other bombs that they hit close to the cafeteria, like, it's such a sad ordeal. And I know this was like the first massive mass shooting in a school. Were there no like plans or trauma recovery help at that time? Like, what did it look like in the days after? What type of support was provided to the students? Because I've always been curious about that.
Yeah, I think things have definitely come so much further, for sure. And there was a lot of not knowing what to do, not having resources. And I was in, I would say, a certain very religious community, and they handled it, I would say, poorly, in the sense that they did not advocate for mental health services at all. In fact, it was more of a belief in the miraculous, and that, your life was spared for a reason, which I think that there was a lot of beliefs that were planted in me at that early stage that created more trauma. Being told as a survivor of a violent trauma that you had absolutely nothing to do with and take no fault in whatsoever, that you now have a responsibility to do certain things in life is not fair for victims. It's just not. It's not fair to tell a victim that because they survived a particular horrific experience that they now have to do certain things as a result of it to make their life worth saving. That created a lot of, I would say, survivors guilt in me, where I felt like, okay, well, because my life was spared for a reason, I now have to go make something of it. Because I survived and my friend did not, my life must have to matter in some way in order for it to have been worth it for me to still be here. And really, it was more of just, this was a horrible experience, and now I just have to choose to continue living and living as best that I can. So that was, I think, a huge thing that came out of it. And I play out in a lot of different ways. There was, you know, a lot of just, I think, this community that, because it just, and you had mentioned just the shock that this could happen. It happens much more frequently now, but what it was like the first, and I think that shock, people didn't know what to do with it. And there was a lot of trying to grapple with the answers and trying to grapple with, you know, how did we get here? What happened? What went wrong? How do we, what do we make of this? And so as far as mental health services, I mean, I remember going to, so, I mean, the Columbine High School shut down for the year. It was obviously a major crime scene. It would take a lot of renovating to get it back to a place that was usable for students. And so we ended up finishing our year at another nearby high school, and they would go to school early in the morning and do a block of time, and we would go in the afternoon. And I remember it was like there was no point. We weren't learning anything at that moment. It was just making it day by day. We would, and people from all over the world were sending in cards and teddy bears, and we would write thank cards. And it was just a very surreal, you know, non-school experience at that moment in time. So school was definitely not normal for me in the days following.
How did your relationships change? Like, how did your relationships with other students change? How did your relationship with your parents change? You mentioned being in a highly religious environment. Yeah. How did that change for you as well?
So many answers to that question. I think one of maybe the most stark examples, though, is I watched how it changed, particularly my relationship with my dad. And so my dad had leukemia. He was in remission at the time of Columbine. He ended up passing away 2 years after Columbine happened because the cancer came back. But I watched how this event, and my dad was always just such a strong, almost stoic individual. I never saw him cry growing up. He was very just unemotional in a lot of ways. Wonderful father, but was. And after Columbine happened, there a key part of my story is it took hours for my dad to get to me. So post the shooting, I had went to a nearby house. I didn't know these people, but they opened their home to me as we are all kind of stuck in this safe area that had been barricaded by police, where ambulances were coming in and taking out the wounded, and they were just keeping all the students there. It was in, you know, a nearby neighborhood. So these people opened their home to me. They allowed me to call my mom. I spoke with my mom, and she was like, "Heidi, are you okay? Did you see people die?" And I said, "Yes, mom." And I just started crying. And she's like, "Well, your dad's on his way to come get you." And I said, "Can you tell him to get here as soon as he can?" I might tear up telling this story. So it took my dad hours to get to me. and everything was barricaded. He was pushing past police lines. He was borrowing cars for people that lived in the neighborhood, doing whatever he could to make it to me. The shooting happened at 11 a.m. I think we were probably in this neighborhood, maybe around noon. He got to me at 5 p.m. that night. And so it took a while, but I watched post all of that. And I just remember opening the door, seeing my dad, giving him the biggest hug, and just feeling like, okay, I'm really safe, because here I was in a stranger's home. This traumatic event just happened to me. I wasn't with anybody that I felt like I could just come undone with, or you could just kind of let it go and just be like, okay, I'm no longer alone in this. And then I see my dad. He and I would travel and speak, and he'd share his side of the story and I would share mine. And I watched my dad, who was, as I mentioned, very stoic, strong, unemotional, not be able to tell his side of the story without crying every single time. Every single time, he became softer. He became much more emotionally accessible to me and to my sisters. He was just a changed person. And I think there was something that just tore his guard down in the process of going through this event. So that, I mean, there were other friendships and relationships that, you know, we're of course impacted, but I think to answer your question, that's the biggest example I can think of as far as how this traumatic event changed, you know, a key and core relationship in my life.
As a parent, I can imagine hearing this or watching it on the news, knowing that my child is there. And even with you being able an hour later to call your mom, and, you know, the panic, the absolute panic that your parents must have experienced, I just can't imagine that. Now, you mentioned safety, that like you weren't in a place where you could, you weren't safe enough to express what was really going on until your father came. I'm curious, has your definition of safety changed from that event to before you were healing on your healing journey to what you would define it now?
Yeah, that's a great question, and one that I haven't really maybe thought through. But I would say that there are people in your life that you can be fully yourself. I mean, there are people that we guard ourselves against, not guard, but just, and it's not even that they're bad, but there's just people that we would maybe not reveal core pieces of ourselves to. And having someone who you can show exactly how you're in that moment and be received with open arms is, I think, a core component of safety, is that I am fully present, I'm fully myself, I'm fully seen in this moment. And which I think is key for me, is that you're gonna do what it takes to take care of me. I was in a place of incredible vulnerability, having gone through that. And there are moments that I can remember, you know, my dad showing up for me in that moment in time. But there was also a moment post Columbine, and I had mentioned panic attacks. And I also think none of us had the tools in our toolkit to deal with any of those things. But we were at Disney World, and they do nightly fireworks there. And that, it kind of came as my system. And when you are someone who has suffered from a traumatic event, you know, where you can be triggered in the sense that your mind is not even in a rational sense, dissociating back to that event, the fireworks and the sound of that put me right back in that library. And we were there and we were stuck there. They were surrounding us, all these fireworks all over. And I remember my dad could see it on my face, because I would just almost go like catatonic, like where I was unresponsive. I would just stare and almost become, you know, like not present, not there. And he pulled me into, I remember this candy shop that was there. I could cry again. And he just goes, Heidi, look at me. Look at me. You're okay. Look at me. And you just needed someone. And I think that's the definition of safety, is somebody who sees you and is like, I got you. I'm going to protect you. And I'm going to do what I need to do to make you okay.
I felt that with all of my being, right? As someone who experienced a near-death experience in my early 20s, I struggled with safety. I never felt safe. I didn't feel safe around people. I didn't feel safe alone. I just never felt safe. And when I got to a place where safety was more, I think I could receive it more, because it's not that safety wasn't available. It wasn't present. I just couldn't receive it as that. And when I got to a place of receiving safety, like being able to really embrace it for what it was almost as if I came down off this massive sugar rush or something. It was like my body was able to just finally, like, you know, like, so I really do understand that. And I guess, like, my final question right now would be, what was the biggest part of your healing? Like, you know, I would say, like, being able to get to a place where I truly loved myself was like a massive thing, or being able to understand how my thought processes impacted my actions was massive for me in my healing process. Yeah. What would you say was like that standout aha moment that really helped you start navigating things from a place where your nervous system is a little bit more regulated and you may not be like strangling the trauma still, you know?
I mean, it's been a journey. It definitely, I think one of the things that I remember though, and it was a crossover, I had mentioned earlier, just having so much survivor's guilt and, you know, being in the religious circle that I was, people would say, oh, look at her, she's a miracle. And I, let's use her to be able to tell the story of how God saves people. And I was almost exploited, I would say, in a lot of ways. It was exploitative. It was taking my story and it was using it to garner religious following, is what was happening to me. And I wore that. I wore that for 10 years of me feeling like I was not good enough, because I was maybe struggling in my head about things. And I was struggling in the aftermath of dealing with these very difficult, complex emotions that at many times did not make sense to me. Where post a trauma, there are things that go on in your head. There are things that happen to you that, if you don't know what's happening, are very scary to go through, where you feel I'm losing it. Like, am I crazy? Like, what, why am I feeling and thinking these things? So having kind of entered into a place of safe community where I wasn't necessarily with shooting victims, but I was with people who had suffered from other serious traumas. And I remember having one person in the sense of like just community and safety, where it was okay. It was okay to feel it. It was okay to be like, I don't understand it. It was okay to just be and not have to think I have to do something because I survived. I have to prove my value. It was okay not have any of that. And I think, you know, in this group setting, a person permission to just let it go, you know, that what happened to you, and she said it in so many words, that what happened to you was not your fault. And it's not something that you have to do anything with. And I think just being able to release that to know that it wasn't my fault was big. And I think what that translated into, which is I think so important in healing, is a lot of self-compassion and just looking at yourself through that lens versus a lens of having to prove something. And so at least that was the case. And I think, you know, obviously like the Columbine and anyone who goes through, I think, a very public trauma where and you had mentioned like it's within not even it ever, most people will understand when I say Columbine and I was there. Most people get that. It was a very public trauma to go through, but it was very personal and private to me. What happened to me and how that violated me and how that impacted me was very personal and private, and something that many people don't understand or know what that was like to have to face those things. So a lot of my journey in healing has been having so much self-compassion for myself and extending a lot of grace, particularly because I was taught early on that I had such a sense of duty post this event. And that's what I wore for a very long time.
I don't want it to seem as if I am religious bashing.
Yeah,
but
it's okay.
When it comes to trauma, I struggle with the religious aspects, and mainly around forgiveness and this idea that I have to be more godly than the perpetrator, and let it go and just forgive and move on because, you know, you did survive and all of this stuff. I just struggle with that, you know, and to hear you talk about that and talk about like the weight that religious idealism put on you. I can't relate fully, but I do understand, you know what I mean? Like it becomes very heavy in your own heaviness, having to now put on this armor of I'm a survivor. You know, God must love me more, or, you know, whatever else you process during that time, and how counterintuitive these ideals can be in our healing process, in our ability to actually move forward. So hearing you say, you know, I was finally able in a community to just be okay and give myself permission to move forward beyond what you would have been conditioned to do in that religious environment, I think it's key to talk about, because oftentimes, especially if we're raised in those type of environments, the first thing that we're encouraged to do is run to the pulpit, run to pray. And not that it doesn't help, don't get me wrong, but when it is such a complex trauma, when someone has been faced, like literally faced with losing their lives, there has to be more compassion and less agenda pushing so that the person can process in a way that is safe for them, rather than picking up all of these extra responsibilities as a result of surviving.
That's a really good way of putting it. I think that I look at why it took me a long time to heal, and it is very much, I think, to the faith community that I was a part of, and the level of, it was an interesting community that just did not encourage, I would say, allowing you to feel your emotions and allowing you to have bad days and allowing you to say no. And I'm grateful to have met people along the way that helped change that perspective for me. And I believe that that's why I'm here. I will say too, I think a lot of my healing has also just been like, you have to choose life. And that's something that I'm not choosing it to save the world. I'm not choosing it to, you know, do whatever. I'm choosing it for myself. I want to live. And I don't have answers as to why things happen the way that they happen that day. I don't know that there are answers, really. But it's been 26 years. There have been moments where I have wanted to just numb out, not feel the intensity, the weight, the difficulty of the emotions. There have been times where I have been angry and upset that I have so many people around me that have no idea what it's like to go through something like this and to have to suffer from the ramifications of that and how unfair that feels to me in so many ways. There have been times where I've been just crippled with anxiety and panic and have not wanted to leave my house or apartment, have not wanted to go to certain things like a movie theater or even to like a faith service because I'm worried about shootings there, where I've had that sense of hypervigilance that anything can happen at any moment. But I think gradually, and it's gradual, it's not something that like, oh, all of a sudden I'm gonna choose this. I think it's a gradual day by day, I'm going to choose to live. I'm going to choose not for anyone else, but for myself. I'm going to choose to live. I'm going to choose to not numb out. I'm going to choose to be thankful. I'm going to choose joy because I deserve that, not anyone else. I'm choosing that for me because it's going to make my life better.
I celebrate your choice, Heidi. I celebrate that because a lot of people, you know what I mean? Like this AANANECA, you know, all of these anonymous places are filled with people who couldn't make the choice initially, and they numbed out in certain ways. So I celebrate that, and I celebrate your compassion to yourself, your grace to yourself, because you know anyone who's caught more than one episode of this podcast knows that I am big on compassion, self-compassion, and I think societal compassion needs a step up in so many ways, right? Like one of the reasons why I started this podcast is because I really wanted to have the conversations about the residual impact of trauma, right? Like, panic attacks and anxiety, those are normal, but we don't talk about the survivor's guilt. We don't talk about, you know, what it looks like to have this weight of the world on our shoulders because of our religious beliefs, right? So this is why I want to have these conversations because it's so important that not only people who have overcome trauma understand what it looks like to go through this, but the rest of the world to understand as well, so they can offer a little bit more compassion. You know, we operate from a place of ignorance in this world.
Yes.
I just hope that someone listening to this, it changes their perspective. And it offers them the opportunity to shift the way that they treat someone who has survived, because as you said, it took years and years for you to even get to a place where you started your healing journey, and you know, being in a place like Disney where you know the fireworks, and then being absolutely a catatonic state because it's triggered your trauma. Like, this is what we as survivors have to manage every day. So again, I celebrate your ability to be present, because that's huge as well, because we tend to live in our heads. Wow, I really enjoy this conversation. I mean, I do say that about everyone, but I think coming from a place of absolute ignorance, other than I knew there were trench coats, I knew there were guns, and I knew people died. I really didn't know what went on. Like, even the bomb stuff, I was just sitting here like, wow. So thank you so much for coming on and sharing your story.
Absolutely. My honor.
Is there one key takeaway that you would leave with the audience?
I mean, I think it just goes back to what I was originally saying. We've all had things happen to us in life, but choosing to live is something that I think we owe to ourselves and doing it for ourselves. And there are going to be so many things that happen in life that will keep you in a place of almost being paralyzed if you let it. And I very much so could have let Columbine do that to me. And at times I candidly did, but I don't want to. And it's something that every day I want to choose to live. And I would just encourage anyone, no matter what they've gone through. I know that my trauma is a unique and obviously very violent thing that happened, but it can be something not quite at that level and still impact you every single day. And I think, the more that we can, as you said, show compassion to ourselves, ultimately, what that's going to do is create a more compassionate world. You won't be compassionate to others if you're not showing yourself compassion. And so I think it starts with you, and it starts with you choosing to believe that you deserve a life that's worth living. And there are things that maybe would have told you otherwise, but it's really the truth.
I love that. Listen, audience, you deserve to have a fruitful life despite any traumatic experience, and you have to make that choice. Heidi, thank you so much for your time on Survival Mode Disrupted. And
Thank you for having
audience, you are so
me.
welcome. And audience, I just want to remind you, you were not built to break, but you damn sure were not built to just survive. Disrupt the cycle, reclaim your life, and thrive on your own terms. And I will see you next week. Once again, thank you for joining another episode of Survival Mode Disrupted, hosted by the Survival Mode Disruptor, Letitia. You didn't land here by accident. This conversation, it probably cracked something open on purpose, because survival mode isn't just a phase, it's a pattern, an identity, a prison masked as strength. But here's the truth: you're not broken. You're just unfinished. So if something stirred in you today, don't ignore it. Don't numb it. Move with it. And I want to once again invite you to join Disrupting Survival Mode, the Facebook community where healing is loud and messy and real. I also want to invite you to buy my book, The Survival Mode Exit Plan, because your breakthrough deserves a blueprint. And if you felt seen today, be sure to share this episode with someone who needs to hear it, subscribe, and drop a review. That's how we amplify the voices that need to be heard. And remember, this isn't about fixing yourself. This is about finding yourself again beneath the rubble. Until next time, choose ease, choose power, choose you. This is Survival Mode Disrupted. Let's keep shaking shit up.